Welcome to a special podcast on The Amazing Spider-Man Part 2. My name is Eric Davis. I am the managing editor at Movies.com. And joining me is Sean O'Connell, who's the movie content director at CinemaBlend.com. I need to warn you first, before we get into this discussion about The Amazing Spider-Man 2, this is going to be spoilers, everything, warts and all. If you haven't seen The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and you don't want anything spoiled for you, probably don't listen to this, because we are going to discuss the film, what it got right, what it got wrong, what we want to see in the next one. And Sean, let's start off by saying that, you know, I think we both enjoyed it. I was away last week. I saw a lot of talk about this movie and a lot of people saying really bad things about it. But then there's this, also this contingent of folks that enjoyed it. And I'm one of the people that enjoyed it.
Well, that means you don't have an agenda. I mean, I think there are legitimate people out there who have an agenda. And I don't even think it's against Mark Webb, although I think some people do sort of have something against Webb, too. But I think it's against the Kurtzman-Ortsy screenwriting duo.
Yeah.
And anything that they put their name to is automatically against. You could basically predict ahead of time, sight unseen, before the movie screens, the people who are going to rip it just because those guys are associated with it. But I am still surprised at the level of hatred that was directed at this film, because if you go back and check even like something like Star Trek Into Darkness, which they co-wrote, and if you try and go back and rewatch, it makes very little sense from start to finish. You know, it would still finish with like an 87% or, you know, high 80s for Rotten Tomatoes. But they're treating Amazing Spider-Man 2 like the worst piece of crap that anyone's ever seen, which is so – I mean, I just can't see how you'd watch this film and think that when there's, you know, so much far worse films that exist. And it's – you know, if I see a really mixed review and it's like, oh, I liked this and I liked that, but this didn't work and that didn't work, I totally appreciate that versus this is the worst thing you've ever seen and it's on par with like – the Joel Schumacher Batman movies, which maybe the people just haven't seen those in a long time, but I cannot stack that against Amazing Spider-Man 2 at all.
Yeah, you know what I think a lot of people are having problems with is the tone of it. Right. I think people are being thrown off because they're used to Marvel Studios movies, they're used to superhero movies that are a little bit more gritty, a little bit more realistic, a little bit, you know, catered to older audiences, you know, 18 and above, maybe. Right. And I think to get a Spider-Man trilogy, a new one, that's a little bit more geared towards kids, I think that's throwing people off. And I feel like people feel like they're being dumbed down to a certain extent. But maybe it's not for them. Maybe it's not for you. I think that there's some – and let's start off, because we are going to talk about what it got right, what it got wrong, what we want to see in the next one. Let's start off with what it got right.
Okay.
I think that what the Spider-Man flying through New York City, when Spider-Man is doing his Spider-Man thing,
right?
I think Mark Webb, it's some of the best stuff that I've seen from any of these superhero movies. In terms of a superhero using his powers to save the day,
right?
I love this stuff. I love what he does with Spider-Man going through the city and flying down from some of those opening scenes are just brilliant to watch. If you're a superhero movie fan, and that's some of the stuff that I like the most from this film.
And I don't think in a lot of these comic book movies or superhero movies, we don't get a lot of, you know, the hero in action. There's so much. A lot of times the focus is on the villain, and a lot of times it's setting up whatever type of story, and a lot of it's saved for the third act. But you're right. There's a ton of Spider-Man action sprinkled all throughout this movie, and I'm with you 100%. In terms of just Spider-Man action, it's the best representation of that character we've ever seen.
Yeah, and you compare it to other superheroes. You know, I really like what they do with Captain America when he's in action. I think they actually utilize him in a lot of creative ways. But you look at some of the other superheroes, like Iron Man, and he's in the suit. And, you know, there's only so much you could do with the suit that's right. new that you haven't seen before. There's only so much you could do with Thor throwing his hammer around that you haven't seen before. Same with Batman with his little trinket. Same with Superman.
Yeah.
You know, there's only so much that you could be surprised with, that, you know, a director could surprise you with. Spider-Man, I just felt like when he's soaring through and just kind of webbing around the city and going and then flying down and saving somebody from a car and then jumping over to something else, I just feel like those scenes are so well done. I just think it's the best use of a superhero using his powers in any of these new modern day superhero movies. That's just my opinion.
I agree 100%.
You know, and so yeah, I think that's the best. That's what I think this film really got right. Also, the Gwen Stacy death, I thought was terrific and a really poignant moment in the film. One of the more poignant deaths that I've ever seen in a superhero movie.
If not the most poignant.
Yeah, if not the most poignant. Because I look back and I'm looking – like I immediately came out and I was comparing it to other superhero movies. And I said, what other death in a superhero movie where the person doesn't come back, mind you? You know, because this movie actually had the balls to kill off a character. And I don't think she's coming back. If she does come back, maybe we'll see her in flashbacks or something in part three.
Right.
But I don't think we're going to see Gwen Stacy return, unlike – you know, other characters from other Marvel movies who die and then come back. And so their death doesn't really feel, you know, you don't really feel it. You're not invested in the death because you know they're just going to come back. But this one just really, really hurt. And I was looking at other ones and I'm like, okay, maybe Maggie Gyllenhaal in The Dark Knight, but not really, because her death happens off screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not really invested in that character because they did switch actresses.
Right, correct.
And so, and other than that, what other deaths?
I didn't think there was the chemistry between Christian Bale and Maggie Gyllenhaal that, you know, Garfield and Stone have in these two Spider-Man films either. These two films have been constructed primarily around their relationship. It's been the setup over the course of two films. And you're right, when the payoff comes, it delivers. This will be our shared what the film got right, because everything that we saw, you know, pointed to the fact that this was going to happen. And even when the sequence was beginning, you know, personally, I was like settling in, like, all right, here we go. We're finally going to get to see the Gwen Stacy saga play out. And knowing all the beats of that sequence and knowing what has to happen, I still found myself, when he slows the camera down and you watch the web sort of weaving its way through the pieces of the clock, the gears of the clock, and I thought, foolishly, in the back of my head, I thought, he's going to save her. You know, like you do all the time. You think Peter's going to succeed and he's going to save Gwen and she's not going to die. And when she dies, when she hits the ground, it was really sad. It was really, it struck me as being really tragic. Knowing it's coming and being prepared for it completely, it still really moved me. And the cemetery montage that Webb does after the fact, I thought was beautiful. I thought it was such a great way to show the passage of time and how that character's death affected Peter. I mean, just the fact that those sequences are in this film alone makes me elevate it to a level that no other Spider-Man movie has really come close to.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that a lot of people felt like maybe they wanted the film to end on that dark note.
Yeah.
Of Peter Parker kind of really down in the dumps, really angry, and like kind of an Empire Strikes Back-ish ending. But they decided not to do that. And Mark Webb has said that he didn't want to do that because he felt like he needed to kind of round it out and bring the meaning, the message of the film from the beginning or to the end. And I like how sort of he rebounds from it and becomes Spider-Man again at the end. And
well, I'm with you on this. If you're going to take Gwen away from him, I wanted him to sort of deal with that for longer than they let him. But you're right, the end sequence I love, and him having to come back and get back into the costume, and the kid standing out there in the middle of the street, I thought was fantastic. All of those little choices I thought were great.
Yeah, so. I mean, how do we know he's not going to be dealing with that throughout the next one? You know,
he probably will.
I think he's going to be. He's going to have scars from it. You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see a character, you know, him now being Spider-Man in another movie, knowing that his actions as Spider-Man kind of caused the death of, you know, his greatest love.
Oh, dude, multiple people. You know, it's been Ben. It's been Captain Stacy. It's been Gwen now. I mean, Mark Webb is not afraid to eliminate characters from this franchise, and I admire him for that.
Yeah, and you know what? He's one of the only ones that's doing that.
Yeah.
Nobody else really wants to eliminate characters. So I do give him credit for that. And the film did have a nice sort of appeal for kids. One thing I was talking to friends about before this movie came out, and they're saying, you know, they have like 7 or 8 year old boys and they're really super into the superhero movies, but they can't really take them to see Captain America, the Winter Soldier, even though they're big Captain America fans. Yeah. And they're like, can I take them to see The Amazing Spider-Man 2? You know, because they're nervous, you know, and that's one of the things that parents struggle with is they have these big superhero movies. It's huge, all the rage right now. But the ironic part is that some of the kids can't even go see the movies because they're a little too adult.
And I think Sony was really banking on families, you know, to making it out this weekend for the opening weekend. And, you know, I brought my 10-year-old son. The hardest thing for him to watch was Peter and Gwen kissing. So
really, not even the Gwen Stacy death. That wasn't hard.
No, didn't bother him. Wasn't really all that fazed by the death. And so, you know, overprotective me was probably way too sensitive about how he was going to handle that. But no, it was really just all the romantic stuff between the two of them. He was like, ugh, when are they going to be finished? Eliminate this girl. Let's get to Electro. Come on.
and so how did your son feel about the villains? You know, this is where we kind of get to a medium part, I think, between what we liked and what we didn't like. Yeah. And I'm curious to know how kids reacted to the villains, because a lot of people, that's what they come down on this film, are the villains, are Electro.
Yeah.
And how sort of one note, one dimensional the character is. And also Harry Osborn and how his transformation maybe happened a little too fast. So how did your kids feel with Electro? Did they really invest in Electro because the character was a little bit skewed younger for younger kids?
No, here's what they want. Here's what my kid wanted. A cool visual effect, you know, that was being played in an eye-popping visual sequence from a tentpole action picture, you know? Kids don't pay attention to the character development, you know, as much as critics harp on, well, Max Dillon wasn't fully fleshed out. My kid didn't care, you know, like he appreciated Jamie Foxx, you know, in the nerdy sort of sense. He thought it was funny that he was singing Happy Birthday to himself before he fell into the pit of electric eels. He thought the Times Square sequence was unbelievable. And so, you know, and even with the Green Goblin stuff, it's weird because, you know, I think with the these heroes having shows on, you know, like cartoon shows and shows on Cartoon Network, and there's a history where they might know the comic books. And so when they knew Harry, he just knew he was going to become the Green Goblin. And I don't know if it's something that he just absorbed through osmosis or what, but so when he transformed, it wasn't like it was rushed or anything. And I don't think it's the kind of scenario, like in this universe, where you are trying to get to a surprising and dramatic spot, you have to lay a lot of groundwork. With this, it's almost like, well, we know he's going to become Green Goblin, so let's just get to it. And so, yeah, maybe it is rushed in the time period, but my kid went into it sort of knowing that Green Goblin was coming. So when it happened, he was just happy that he was there, because then it meant here comes more action.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see their use of Harry Osborn in this, because in the Sam Raimi movies, you know, Harry has an arc throughout three films and doesn't really kind of get his rock on until closer to the end. That was probably my biggest problem with this film was Harry Osborn, only because once you take Gwen Stacy out of the picture, that Harry Peter relationship is the relationship now that you have to be the most invested in.
Right.
And this film doesn't really give you any time to invest in it before he turns bad. And now going into a third movie, that's the relationship, I think, that a lot of people, you know, because they're going to introduce Mary Jane and figure out a way to set that up. But in the meantime, while they do that, you're really supposed to be invested in this Peter versus Harry. But they are not friends for long enough, and you don't really feel their friendship deteriorate in any kind of way in this film. So that way, I don't know how invested you will be with – when it comes to the two of them and their sort of battle in the third one. I mean, obviously, I think Peter is going to be pretty pissed off at him.
Right.
For killing his girl. But, you
know, it's a quick exit, too. Like, Green Goblin's all of a sudden, that was a bad resolve. You know, like, last we see him, he's tied up at the top of the tower. And then, you know, next thing you know, spoiler, he's in Ravenscroft somehow, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that Webb sort of rushed through that also. It's so interesting that, like, there are chunks of scenes that you know were shot already, you know, that were filmed and stuff that just didn't make it into the final cut.
There had to be a lot more between him and Harry and Peter, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's been happening to Webb since he took over this franchise. In fact, someone just sent me a link this morning and asked me to sign this petition to allow him to release a director's cut of this film, because there are just scenes that, like, you see – there are photos you can find online of Andrew Garfield and Shailene Woodley. Like, apparently there's a big chunk of scenes that took place from when Gwen got accepted into Oxford and when she's leaving to go to the plane. And then, of course, they have to do this weird – you know, like, she's leaving him a voicemail message because they took out this whole chunk of stuff. And it's them – it's like it's Sony trying to serve a bigger picture versus allowing a filmmaker to just tell the story that he wants to tell. And it's hard. And I think that this is going to be a problem that all of these major franchises have as we move forward. As we keep announcing sequel dates and filmmakers have to keep setting up the next story, and it's going to be that problem for Star Wars. It's going to be that problem for the Justice League and the Batman movies and Superman. It's been a problem for Marvel. It's going to continue to be a problem for Marvel. You can't just tell this standalone story anymore because you now know that you have to build towards something bigger, and it's hard on these individual films.
Yeah, yeah. I think the film that suffered the most from that so far was Iron Man 2.
Right.
I just think that film got crushed in sort of trying to live up to the first one while also trying to set up this larger universe that now fans were freaking out about. And since then, Marvel Studios has really settled down and found some nice way to turn each film as a standalone but also set up more. I think that The Amazing Spider-Man 2 does do a good job. You know, I did hear a lot of criticisms that it's all set up. But it's really not. I think Webb gives you a lot of answers from the first film in this one. Including, you know, Peter's parents and a lot with that, right. A resolution to the Peter-Gwen relationship. I think there's a lot that happens in this film that isn't set up, that is answering stuff from that first film. But then also setting up other future films. And let's not keep crapping on Spider-Man 2 for doing that, because all the other superhero movies do that too.
They do.
Yes. And all the other ones have villain problems as well. You know, this one, yeah, this movie does have villain problems, but with the exception of Loki and Heath Ledger's The Joker.
Right.
What other superhero movie doesn't have villain problems? You know, I think The Winter Soldier was kind of a bland villain that you couldn't really invest in, even though I do think that film was probably a bit more successful than this one. But these other films don't have really engaging villains either. And I think that's a problem that all of these superhero movies need to address. And they need to look at Loki and why he's become such a popular character.
Right.
And find a little bit more depth to these villains, especially if they want to have them in multiple films.
So let's get to what we want to see in the sequel. And let's first go over this. Is the next Spider-Man movie going to be Amazing Spider-Man 3, or are they going to go right to Sinister Six? Because I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either.
I'm not sure Sony does either. I mean, based on the numbers that are coming back, they're good, but they're not great. You know, for a standalone summer movie, a $92 million opening would be fine. But the Spider-Man movies have decreased from film to film to film to film. And I just feel that Sony might feel right now that they need to do something big to switch it up. Yeah, and I don't think that a third Spider-Man movie before you get to a Sinister Six is going to be enough of a solution. So I think that they might try to do the Drew Goddard Sinister Six story next and just use the Rhino sequence at the end of this one to sort of be the springboard into that. Because they did sort of set it up. You know, Harry was basically recruiting the Sinister Six. They showed the Doc Ock arms. They showed the vulture wings. They show you the Rhino as being the first sort of volunteer for this program. But no one knows what that movie is yet.
Well, that's the whole thing. And how do you make a movie You know, people understand the Sinister Six. People that read the comics understand it. All the fanboys understand it. But these movies aren't just made for fanboys. They're made for the really, really huge, large, worldwide audiences. And how do you make a quote-unquote Spider-Man movie without Spider-Man? And is Spider-Man in this movie? Is he – and it's if he's – what?
Is it Andrew Garfield?
Yeah, no. And is it Andrew – I mean, I think Andrew Garfield's definitely signed on for at least another one. But yeah, I think from the standpoint of them needing to explore their villains more and give them some more depth, I think it would be fun to see a Sinister Six movie, because then I think after that, if you have a film like The Amazing Spider-Man 3, where some of these villains appear in, then maybe, yeah, it'll be – you'll find some more investment in these villains because you'll have a whole film that where you saw them in. But I just don't know what that – film would look like, and I don't know how audiences would approach a film that's really just about the villains. I mean, maybe we need to see how Maleficent does, and if that crushes at the box office and says, look, people want movies based on villains where villains are the central characters. I think villains are the more complicated than heroes to begin with, so I'd love to see more movies about villains, but I'm just curious to see how audiences would accept that. And
so far the Spider-Man movies have not established a clear-cut villain that I'd want to see for multiple films. They just haven't. I mean, I liked Electro and I liked Green Goblin, but if you're telling me that it's, you know, not Jamie Foxx but Dane DeHaan, you know, being the leader of this new Sinister Six for a complete movie, I'm not invested in that just yet. You know, I still want Spider-Man, so
I want to see Spider-Man too. I mean, some of the fun, the best parts of these movies is Spider-Man flying around the city, saving the day. And
right. And
to have an entire movie where maybe that's not happening, I don't know. You know, it's weird. I'd have to see what that movie is about. I imagine Drew Goddard is a very, very smart man. I love what he does.
Yes.
So I imagine that it makes sense once you know more about it. But yeah, I'm curious to see maybe that and to see that Sinister Six movie. I was iffy on Electro. I actually do think that – it's funny. He did remind me of a Schumacher Batman villain. Mm-hmm. But if you think of the audiences that this film is geared towards and you talk about your son, kids don't need more than that.
No.
You know, and if anything, it's easier for a kid to digest and invest in a villain that's a little bit easier for them to digest and invest in. And so I was okay from that level, you know. And then some people will say, so you're explaining off the film's weaknesses by saying it was for kids. You know, but it's a movie for kids.
It should be, you know. The motivation for Harry was, you know, the tainted blood and needing Spider-Man's blood. And I've read a lot of criticisms of like, oh, that's a ridiculous motivation. But that's the kind of motivation that a younger audience needs. If it's any more complicated than that, they're tuning out of it. But I know my kid from first person experience was able to follow that storyline. That was enough. He was like, oh, Harry's sick and he's dying and he needs Spider-Man's blood. I got it. Okay, that's why he hates him. And he's not like, well, that's just not complicated. No, he was like, no, I get that. That's cool. Let's go. So it's a tightrope walk, you know. You're trying to make a movie to please all people, and you're just never going to.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching Spider-Man 3 the other day, and that film, and the Raimi films too. I mean, and it's funny. This film, I think, more so than the first Amazing Spider-Man, really did remind me of Raimi's films in some ways. The villains and some of the action, and I don't know. I felt like there were. The spirit of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies was running through this one a little bit more than the previous ones. I felt specifically with Electro, I felt like he was a throwback villain to those early 2000 superhero movies,
right.
Where the villains weren't so, I guess, complex and in depth and, you know, running through their multiple therapy sessions. And I just felt like they were simple when the villain was simple. You know, it's I'm a nerdy guy, but I got some anger issues in me and nobody understands me. And I fall into this vat of electric eels and voila, I'm this villain with all these powers. And now I hate Spider-Man. It was just this kind of simple 1-2-3.
Well, I got one more thing that I really want to see in the upcoming movies. And what? It's hinted at here, and it has to be a bigger function, and it's Norman Osborn. I mean, as a Spider-Man fan, Norman Osborn to me is the – he is the Joker to Peter Parker's Spider-Man. You know, yeah. He's Lex Luthor. And if you had told me years ago that you were going to have a Spider-Man movie, you know, that they had Harry become the first Green Goblin, I would be furious. But for whatever reason, it's working in these pictures, and it doesn't bother me quite as much as, you know, a major change to mythology should. And I think only because Webb teased enough that, you know, you cast Chris Cooper, you're going to bring him back for something. And there was a scene that they showed when they were clearing out Norman's room. There's a green laser that sort of sweeps over Norman's body, and I talked to Webb and asked him about that, and he wouldn't elaborate on what it is, but he did say that that's important. Hmm. And it's enough to let me know that Norman's going to be a factor later. And so while I might not be invested in the Peter-Harry relationship just yet, and maybe it'll grow, and maybe the fact that Harry killed Gwen is going to be a big factor, I think having Norman hanging out over the franchise and with them deciding when they're going to bring him in is enough for me to look forward to that in the coming movies, because that's going to be the standoff of the face-off that I really want to see. I just think that he is the quintessential, especially how they're going to use it. So.
Yeah, I agree. I hope so too. And I really love that scene with Chris Cooper. I thought he was good in it, and I want to see more of him. And so I hope we do see more.
Did you see his goblin hands?
He was freaky. I want to know more about that. Like, what's his sickness? I think a lot of people were kind of, making fun of it, you know, because it's like he's got this goblinitis. What is that? You know, but that's kind of, it's kind of a cool mystery that I want to know more about this. And what is this that they're stricken with, and why are they turning into this? And I think it's kind of cool.
Back to the thing that I think the franchise got right just briefly. I think making Oscorp the central bad guy is a really smart idea that maybe they lucked into. But it allows them to keep rolling out these new villains without having to set up new origins for them each time. It's always going to be tied to Oscorp, which some things that makes the universe too small. But I think that that's perfect. It's a good fit to have these, you know, these new and animal-based villains keep coming out of this stuff. Because when you realize Spider-Man had a ton of animal-based villains from Vulture, Dr. Octopus, Lizard, Rhino, they all were there anyway. This was a clever way to get into that.
It is. So we like The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was a fan of it. I think it's I give it credit for not trying to just be a complete copycat of the Marvel Studios films. And kind of going its own way by skewing a little bit younger, because many of these don't do that. And giving 7 and 8 year olds an actual superhero movie that they can go see, that it's not too old for them. And so I admire that about it. And I think Mark Webb's doing a great job with the Spider-Man action. I think it's brilliant. I can't wait to see more of it. And again, he only did Spider-Man's POV for like one or two shots. I want to see more Spider-Man POV.
Yeah, I can see that, especially with the 3D and IMAX working as well as it did. So.
I remember after The Amazing Spider-Man, we had that conversation, and I was like, if he could just do more Spider-Man POV, and he definitely gave us more Spider-Man flying, some of those, more of that. But then, and I was making sure to pay attention for when he switched to the POV. He did it like once or twice in those opening scenes, and then he didn't do it again. If Mark Webb, if you listen to this, more POV. I love that stuff. It's really cool.
So we have release dates for Spider-Man sequels. We just don't know what they're going to contain yet. And I think that this is an exciting – I still think it's an exciting time for this franchise. Nothing that I saw in part two makes me think that they're on the wrong path. But it is a little bit sobering seeing the box office numbers come across. I don't know if people have just hit Spider-Man fatigue.
I don't know. I think 92 million opening I think you could do worse than that.
Oh yeah, no, I know.
I definitely don't think we're hitting Spider-Man fatigue. I think people are into it, and we'll have to see what happens.
We will. We got a long summer. Are we going to keep talking about big blockbusters?
I hope so. I think we're going to. I think we're going to sort of do a summer movie podcast, and I want to talk about the big movies with you. And so hopefully we will keep talking about them, and maybe we will. If you listen to this, let us know if you want to.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, Mr. Sean O'Connell, thank you so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
My name is Eric Davis. His name is Sean O'Connell. Visit cinemablend.com. Visit movies.com for tons more on The Amazing Spider-Man 2. I'm sure Sean's got some crazy interviews and features over on CinemaBlend. We have a bunch of stuff over on movies.com, interviews with Mark Webb, including where he talks about Mary Jane Watson and where she was supposed to fit it into this film. So you can see that over there as well. And thank you. And Amazing Spider-Man 2 is still in theaters. Go see it, enjoy it, listen to this podcast, and let us know what you think. Have a good one.